Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to take a look at a speculative line of inquiry, something that follows up on the work that I've done in the past on Operation Gladio. Operation Gladio was the Italian component of a NATO operation called Operation Stay Behind, in which guerrilla groups were set up to harass the Red Army in the event of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe or in the event of a communist takeover of a Western European country. As we've seen in those numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire, that NATO program ultimately resulted in the utilization of fascist groups as enforcers or a cadre for this program, and many of those fascist groups then engaged in terror programs and assassination and kidnapping programs as a component of Operation Gladio. We took a look at that in RFA 19 about the strategy of tension, among other programs. What we're going to look at next is a manuscript prepared by Kevin Coogan, the brilliant author of the landmark text Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. Kevin has authored a paper about a domestic Gladio. It is speculative in nature, and we're going to rely on his paper about a domestic Gladio for this program. The following is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of December 19th of 1999. This is called American Gladio, and it's an investigative report by Kevin Coogan, last name capital C-O-O-G-A-N. It's copyright 1999, and there is no reproduction without permission. I have obtained Kevin's permission for this. And the introduction reads, "This copy is meant for the private use of the reader as an investigative resource. It is speculative and does not represent any final conclusion by the author. It is also excerpted with edits from a longer report, April 2nd, 1999. Let me stress that this document is not available to the general public, and it is with permission of Kevin Coogan that I am reading this or excerpting this on the air, and a tip of the hat, obviously, to Kevin in that context. Skipping ahead into the document, we're going to review some information for veteran listeners, and also I'm going to read some parts of the document that we have not heard before. Section 2 of this document is entitled A Domestic, quote, Operation Gladio, unquote, and it reads as follows. Given the extremely complex relationship between members of the radical right and local and federal police agencies, it is extremely difficult to unravel all the hidden motives at work. Undoubtedly, there was concern about possible rightist acts of violence against public figures, particularly foreign diplomats. There was also an attempt to monitor anti-Jewish and anti-black extremists. Yet any analysis of the ties between the government and far-right extremists must also acknowledge that a symbiotic relationship existed between certain elements of the far-right and the national security apparatus. The relationship between the domestic U.S. right and the intelligence community may be understood first by briefly looking at the CIA's and USA's military intelligence ties to the European far-right, most prominent in the Operation Gladio scandal. Operation Gladio was the code name for the Italian branch of a European-wide attempt by American intelligence to supply select far-right activists with weapons, training, and undercover support, which in Italy was run as a joint operation of Italian intelligence, or CIFAR, and the CIA. Gladio's purpose, on paper anyway, was to supply extreme anti-communists with training and secret weapons caches so that in the case of a Soviet invasion, the skeleton of an in-place resistance movement would already exist. In practice, however, many of the Gladio warriors appeared to have been involved in terrorist acts against the Italian Communist Party, or PCI-dominated left. The name Gladio hints at its dual purpose, since it meant a double-edged short sword used during Roman times. By the mid-1950s, when Gladio funding really took off, the CIA's principal fear was not the threat of Soviet tanks crossing the Alps, but the danger that the Italian Communist Party either could take power electorally or enter power in a coalition with the progressive wing of Italy's Christian Democrats. Under crisis conditions, like a new Berlin blockade or another Cuban Missile Crisis, such a government might opt for a neutralist position in opposition to NATO. What is known in Italy as the strategy of tension, unquote, emerged in the late 1950s as a kind of ongoing, low-intensity warfare operation aimed at keeping the left off balance. Gladio was the cutting edge of an American policy to encourage the growth of strong rightist political groups to counterbalance the communists. Some hint of the CIA's goal comes from a leading CIA bureaucrat named Richard Bissell. Before entering the CIA, Bissell had a series of talks about the effectiveness of psychological warfare with Frank Wisner, an Alan Dulles protege, who was then CIA Director of Planning. Bissell recalled that, quote, Frank was fascinated by the Russians' ability to put a mob on the street anywhere they chose, anytime they chose. He wanted to be able to do the same, unquote. Before coming to the CIA, Wisner had served as a crucial liaison to the extreme right while heading the State Department's Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, in the late 1940s. Once inside the CIA, he tried to develop support for the United States inside the European far right, which had strong third camp armed neutralist tendencies and saw both America and Russia as occupying powers. The CIA particularly courted ex-fascist military men. In Italy, it tried hard to woo the Italian right's Black Prince, Junio Valerio Borghese, a leading fascist military hero and convicted war criminal, who in 1953 became president of the CIA-backed pro-Atlanticist fascist party in Italy, the MSI, or Movimento Sociale Italiano. By the way, Borghese, the MSI, and related elements discussed at great length in RFA 19, and the entire series about the shooting of the Pope, that's RFA programs 17 through 21. Continuing, this next section is called German Gladio, question mark. There was a similar CIA and military intelligence play to the diehards inside the German far-right and military. The U.S. was caught setting up Minutemen-like assassination squads to attack the left during a Soviet invasion. By the way, the Minutemen, which we're going to talk about in a minute, were a paramilitary right-wing group in the United States and arguably the forerunners of today's militia groups. Continuing. In 1953, the local state government of Hesse exposed the existence of an American-backed organization called the Bund Deutscher Jugend, BDJ, or League of German Youth, led by Paul Lüth, that's L-U-umlaut-T-H. Continuing, the BDJ's, quote, technical emergency service, unquote, branch was discovered to be keeping lists of German Social Democratic members to be arrested or assassinated during a Soviet assault. Since the Hesse government was at that time run by the SPD, the local authorities were less than pleased. After August Zind, Z-I-N-D, the minister-president of Hesse, revealed the role that American intelligence had played in supplying weapons, money, and training bases for the BDJ's secret army, the October 10, 1952 New York Times claimed that American officials had been unaware of any illegal activity and felt that their trust had been betrayed. According to the spin doctors at the New York Times, quote, United States authorities said they felt that the guerrilla training program was not in itself wrong, though possibly unwise. They said that what most concerned them was the proclivity of the Germans involved for engaging in political activities that possibly had degenerated into a conspiracy against political and government leaders. By the way, I believe that not only was there an American Gladio, but that it degenerated into a similar fashion. And I think that, as we'll talk about in a minute, the social chaos in this country in the late 1960s, the anti-Vietnam War movement at a time when an American foreign war against communism was going badly, combined with the more militant aspects of the civil rights movement and black power movement, with some of the urban riots that were taking place, with a large percentage of the flower of American youth, so to speak, protesting against the war and taking drugs and getting involved with the hippie thing, I think that many of these Gladio networks were utilized in a domestic capacity and were used for committing assassinations, among other things. Continuing. The CIA's BDJ blunder was merely at the tip of the iceberg. Both the OPC and the CIA worked hard to entice leading German military men like General Hans Guderian to enter the American camp. In the late 1940s, the State Department secretly brought to Washington a group of top Nazis that included Günter Dahlken, D'ALQUN, an SS theorist, werewolf leader, and editor-in-chief of the SS journal Das Schwarze Korps. By the way, the werewolves were a group of guerrillas put together by the Third Reich during the closing day months of the war to fight against the Allied armies behind the front lines. Continuing. After seeing the sights in D.C., Dahlken returned to Germany, where he served as a liaison man between American intelligence and Guderian. The next section of the discussion refers to the DSE, or the Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, und the Deutsche National Zeitung und Soldatenzeitung. That is the paper run by German Nazi linchpin Gerhard Frey, and it was in this newspaper that the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald fired at Edwin Walker was first reported. Some 4 days before Marina Oswald first reported this to the first disclosed this to the light of day, obviously calling into question the Warren Commission's hypothesis. More about that later. Continuing. One fruit of the CIA state effort with the Germans was a Munich-based newspaper called the Deutsche Soldatenzeitung, or DSZ, German Soldiers News. The DSZ began as a weekly in June of 1951 as the house organ of the Bund ehemaliger Deutscher Soldaten, the Protective League of Former German Soldiers, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation. Continuing. In The New Germany and the Old Nazis, T.H. Tettens describes the paper this way. Although professing support for Europe and NATO defense, every article reveals that the DSC envisions a Europe more like that once blueprinted by the Waffen-SS. The columns of the paper do not contain a single repudiation of Hitler's regime, the Nazi doctrines, or the wanton aggressions against Germany's neighbors, nor is there an outright condemnation of the crimes committed by the SS and the Wehrmacht. Almost every issue is filled with articles defending the Nazi past, glorifying Prussia's great soldierly tradition, unquote, and praising the honor of the SS, unquote. The DSZ has relentlessly attacked the Nuremberg trials as revenge of the victors, unquote. It appeared as the loudest voice in the chorus demanding the release of all war criminals, and it has branded Democrats and Social Democrats as licensed 1945ers, unquote, traitors, unquote, and fellow travelers, unquote. As its political objective, the DSZ has peddled the old cliché of a powerful Reich, the return of the lost territories in the East, and even the Anschluss of the Sudetenland, unquote. And Kevin then continues, in 1957, a court action instituted by the DSZ revealed that the paper, from the time of its founding, had secretly been subsidized by the press office of the Bonn government, which was controlled by Allied intelligence since Germany did not become a sovereign state again until 1955. The German Defense Ministry was also making donations to the DSZ kitty. The close ties between the DSZ and the military led its editor-in-chief Erich Kernmeyer to boast, quote, "There is no secret in the Defense Ministry of which we are not informed through our friends in the ministry in less than 24 hours, unquote. Then Kevin discusses the effect on domestic American national security thinkers, the military in particular, of alleged communist brainwashing techniques. Many experts on mind control have contended that, in fact, communist techniques were far behind those that Western countries, in particular the United States, had developed. And that remains, to a certain extent, a bone of political contention. But it certainly had a lot of domestic political distribution, and so it acquired a distinct and very important domestic political weight, so to speak. In a section called The Korean War Brainwashing Disaster, Kevin writes, "In the United States itself, there was a similar threat to NATO's resolve, which was symbolized in the ability of the North Koreans and their Chinese and Russian advisors to brainwash, unquote, American GIs in POW camps during the Korean War. It is hard today to grasp the profound shock that the brainwashing of American GIs had on both the military, the CIA, and the doyens of American culture. To the American security establishment, the problem was clear. If trained American soldiers could not stand up to communist propaganda techniques in a crisis situation, how could the American public's resolve to fight communism be trusted in a larger, possibly nuclear war-threatening crisis? The rise of teenage culture began a generational detachment from the demands of an internationalist empire locked in a deadly battle against a ruthless totalitarian foe. And what about momism, unquote? The fear that the strong presence of the mother in the nuclear family would erode an entire generation's masculine identity. How would they respond to the threat of a Soviet nuclear bombardment? Morally corrupted by its vast post-war prosperity, had America, like Rome, gone soft?" This next section is a critical element of this document, and I think Kevin has quite correctly focused on a 1958 NSC directive as a vitally important element in the evolution of American political reaction. Indeed, I think the ultimate results of this document and its implications were to result as the elements stemming from this document. The events stemming from this document were to result, in part at least, in America's political assassinations of the 60s and early 70s. This section is called the 1958 NSC Directive, and it is very important. In the summer of 1958, at a time when China began increasing its artillery attacks on Komoi and Matsu, by the way, those are a couple of islands between Taiwan and mainland China, Eisenhower's National Security Council, or NSC, issued a classified directive ordering that the military begin active propaganda operations inside the American civilian population to reinforce the Cold War effort. This last sentence again, because this is critical, and the implications of this NSC document are massive. In the summer of 1958, at a time when China began increasing its artillery attacks on Komoi and Matsu, Eisenhower's National Security Council issued a classified directive ordering that the military begin active propaganda operations inside the American civilian population to reinforce the Cold War effort. Again, the implications of this are enormous because with this document, a major focal point of American military activity became the changing of American domestic political attitudes, and the constitutional implications of this document couldn't be exaggerated. Continuing. As a July 14, 1961 Washington Post column by Marcus Childs observed, the NSC directive, quote, was a radical departure from American tradition, which has held that the place of the military in American life is strictly limited to the professional task of training and equipping the armed services for the nation's defense, unquote. The importance of the 1958 NSC directive was spelled out by Edward Hunter, a journalist who worked for both the OSS and the CIA on questions involving psychological warfare. He became a leading expert on, quote, brainwashing, unquote, a term he coined in books like Brainwashing in Red China and Brainwashing from Pavlov to Powers. In his July 11, 1961 testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee's subcommittee to investigate the administration of the Internal Security Act, Hunter explained that, quote, our North Korean experiences showed our youth have been the butt of softening up pressures subtly incorporated into our own society, weakening and corrupting as fiber. In the past, the teaching of physical survival stamina was sufficient. The home, clergy, and schools could be depended on to provide the morality. This wasn't true anymore. Mental survival stamina had now to be superficially taught. We are given no alternative except surrender, unquote. The crisis first made evident in Korea had spread to the population in general and had become a key factor in overt Soviet operations against America. Hunter told the subcommittee, quote, this overt operation is a reflection of Khrushchev's frequently uttered contempt for the United States. He is basing his war against us on the premise that we have been sufficiently softened up to be unreachable by patriotism or loyalty, what I have referred to as mental survival stamina, and that we are sure to be a pushover, needing a mere coup de grace perhaps without appreciable danger of retaliation in any effective manner. This, gentlemen, is the psychological basis on which the Reds are working, and they consider themselves objective and practical, unquote. And Kevin goes on to add, the 1958 NSC directive was meant to stiffen the national spine. Both active and retired military men became heavily involved in ultra-patriotic groups. Public seminars on the menace of communism were held on military bases. Retired Colonel Gunter Hartel's American Strategy Incorporated was formed to give public lectures on communism. Other groups like the Foreign Policy Research Institute, the Institute for American Strategy, the Richardson Foundation, the National War College, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff began working together. Far-right operations like Dr. Fred Schwartz's Anti-Communism Crusade held seminars on Navy bases. Quote, fourth-dimensional warfare seminars, unquote, were also organized with the active support of top military leaders. In short, there was a fusing of cultural, military, and economic interests into an entity that a worried President Eisenhower would label, quote, the military-industrial complex, unquote. This last sentence again, because it's critical. In short, there was a fusing of cultural, military, and economic interests into an entity that a worried President Eisenhower would label, quote, the military-industrial complex, unquote. The next section here is called Pro Blue, and this I'm not going to read this entire section. This refers to Major General Edwin Walker's Pro Blue program with his troops. This was a program under which Walker was indoctrinating the troops under his command from the Blue Book of the John Birch Society, and this ultimately caused him to be relieved of his command. Kevin Coogan hypothesizes that this Pro Blue program ultimately was the focal point of liberal anti-communists in this country, because one of the things that the 1958 NSC directive did was to unleash a storm of propaganda from the American far right, both within and outside of the military, against liberal anti-communist elements such as some of the AFL-CIO elements grouped around Walter Reuther, who ultimately in all likelihood was assassinated, as we've seen in an article authored by Michael Parenti, that from Covert Action Quarterly, and that's available from Spitfire, both an interview with Parenti about that and an actual reading of the article. In the pro-blue section of Kevin Coogan's document, Kevin writes, "The 1958 NSC directive was designed to strengthen America's spine, not break it. But as soon as the policy was implemented, it took on political tones. Time and time again, speakers from groups like the John Birch Society and right-wing generals used the forums to attack American liberalism. Supposedly, trans-ideological gatherings aimed at uniting America turned into attacks on the Council on Foreign Relations, the IRS, the Americans for Democratic Action, and other rightist bête noire. One wing of the national security establishment was effectively beginning to attack another wing of the same establishment. What was meant to bring the nation together was now rapidly threatening to drive it apart." Again, note my many comments that our national security establishment is anything but monolithic. It has many factions, and sometimes those factions fight. Skipping ahead in Kevin's document, part of the domestic gladio that he hypothesizes involved the Minutemen, a paramilitary right-wing group that in many ways could be thought of as the forerunner for some of today's militia groups. That, by the way, the line of ontogenetic succession is discussed in a lecture available from Spitfire entitled "The Militias, Enemy or Pawn of the State." Continuing, "How far the CIA and military intelligence went in the attempt to bolster the American public's resistance to communism remains to be fully researched. While the American Communist Party was weak, there was always the danger that coalitions of peace and civil rights groups might gain considerable credibility in a crisis situation, especially if it appeared that the country was heading toward nuclear annihilation." By the way, bear in mind what this is describing events in the late 50s and early 60s. Just imagine how this must have looked to people in the late 60s and early 70s with the Vietnam War, the Black Power movement, and so forth. Continuing with Kevin's document, "Soviet psychological warfare tactics would be aimed at exacerbating just these fears in a future geopolitical confrontation. This may have been one reason why the FBI was particularly obsessed with Dr. Martin Luther King's possible relationship to the American Communist Party. Groups like SANE, that's Americans for a Sane Nuclear Policy, the American Friends Service Committee, the ADA, the National Council of Churches, etc., were all potential problems. Right-wing isolationist groups could also come under attack. In such a crisis atmosphere, groups like the Minutemen with fanatically trained cadre, easy access to high-power weapons, and an extensive list of left-wing groups and individuals could serve as a limited counter-response shock force in times of crisis. The possibility, therefore, exists that someone like Guy Bannister was as much involved in penetrating groups like the Minutemen and establishing relations with Rockwell as part of an overall national security contingency option. Someone like Bannister would have been a kind of in-place administrator for an off-the-shelf, unquote, U.S. version of Gladio, which could rapidly expand during a crisis. Despite such concealment tactics, public awareness of Gladio-type activity was shown by the popularity of 7 Days in May, which posits a military coup d'etat plot after a liberal president enters into an arms agreement with the Russians." And again, just imagine what the late 60s and early 70s looked like to these same elements. We're going to return to an earlier section. Now, you saw the reference there to Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister, who's one of the people who figured prominently in Jim Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination, and an individual very familiar to veteran listeners to this program, Guy Bannister is the focal point of the early part of Kevin's document. The first section of Kevin's document is entitled, appropriately enough, Bannister's World. And note the many connections of this individual. William Guy Bannister remains one of the most intriguing figures in the Oswald mystery. Born in Louisiana in 1901, he joined the FBI in the 1930s. After working for the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, during World War II, he returned to the Bureau and became Special Agent in Charge, or SAC, of the FBI's Chicago office. Bannister resigned from the FBI in either 1954 or 1955 and returned to New Orleans, where he served as Assistant Superintendent of Police until he was fired in 1957. He then created his own detective agency, Guy Bannister & Associates. A fierce racist and anti-communist, he published the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which regularly attacked the civil rights movement as a communist conspiracy. In the early 1960s, he became Louisiana coordinator for the Minutemen. Note again Kevin's hypothesis about the Minutemen. In 1954, by the way, I would interject in numerous works, but in particular the landmark recent text entitled Let Justice Be Done by William Davey, published in softcover by Jordan Publishing, copyright 1999, the involvement of the Bannister Detective Agency and David Ferry, the initial focal point of Garrison's investigation, and himself a member of the Minutemen, along with a fellow named Jerry Brooks and other of Bannister's associates, the Bannister Detective Agency, and probably some of the domestic Gladio networks that Kevin hypothesizes here, appear to have been utilized in some of the anti-Castro Cuban efforts of the early 1960s. Continuing, and bear in mind Bannister's Minutemen connection here, he was the Louisiana coordinator for the Minutemen. In 1954, Bannister helped found the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, or ACL. The ACL, later affiliated with the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, or APACL, a far-right, CIA-backed organization now known as the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL. The ACL's general counsel, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, was a close Bannister associate. New Orleans had the largest Cuban exile community next to Miami. Since Batista's Cuba was part of the ACL, it seems logical to assume that Bannister's anti-Castro activity began well before Fidel Castro took power in January of 1959. And the next connection is a very interesting one. In addition to Bannister's anti-Castro activity, Guy Bannister was very close to George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose Arlington, Virginia name, address, and telephone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of Oswald's arrest. Note that Oswald also has been definitively linked to the Bannister Detective Agency, not only by the address on his Fair Play for Cuba pro-Castro literature, but also by numerous other accounts from people associated not only with Guy Bannister, but other people in the New Orleans area. And again, the recent book and wonderful text, Let Justice Be Done by William Davey, bears witness to that. Continuing. Most important for our purposes, Bannister and Gatlin are reported to have maintained close contact with Nazi leader George Lincoln Rockwell, who was extremely active in Louisiana. Bannister's previous affiliation with the FBI was no hindrance to Rockwell, since the Nazi leader was well known for his support of the FBI. Rockwell's views especially alienated him from the National States Rights Party, or NSRP, whose members had been arrested by the FBI in the late 1950s for attempting to bomb an Atlanta synagogue. By the way, among the members of the National States Rights Party were Jerry Ray, James Earl Ray's brother, James Earl Ray the Patsy, in the assassination of Martin Luther King. I would note that one of James Earl Ray's many attorneys, who wasn't exactly enthusiastic in getting James Earl Ray off the hook, was J.B. Stoner, the founder of the NSRP.
That, again, from an essay called Domestic Gladio by Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Postwar Fascist International. This was, in turn, was excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of December 19th of 1999. We're going to continue with this reading and analysis on the other side of this tape. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.